From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. More than 100 people are still missing after tornadoes ripped through six states on Friday. Worst hit, Kentucky, where at least 64 people are dead. And Governor Andy Beshear says he expects that number to rise.
I'm not doing so well today, and I'm not sure how many of us are. I was working on getting the confirmed deaths this morning and realized I was writing on the back of notes that one of my kids took from school.
Deaths were also reported in Illinois, Tennessee, Arkansas, and Missouri. Sierra Carr is one of many people taking stock of the damage today. Her family owns two restaurants in Mayfield, Kentucky, Carr's Steakhouse and Carr's Barn Barbecue. Hi, Sierra.
Hello.
Now, your family's restaurants are across the street from each other. What happened on Friday night?
The tornado, you know, it blew through, and they are saying that it was about a mile wide. So the street that both of our family businesses were on, called West Broadway, the tornado traveled directly down that path, and it took out everything on West Broadway, which is our downtown area. So our whole downtown is completely gone as well. Both my parents and my four-year-old sister were at the establishment during the storm. Trying to get at, you know, at this time we had a full dining room, we had Christmas parties, and so they were trying to get people out safely, because we knew that that building was not, it was not safe for anybody to be in that type of storm. So we got everybody out, including our employees. My dad was actually the last one in the building with some of our employees. And he said, had he been there, you know, 10 minutes later, it would have been a completely different story.
Wow. So how did your dad get the word to get people out in time?
Well, you know, we were being cautious all day, you know, watching the news. We had known that there was a potential catastrophic storm heading our way. So we aired caution. Some of our employees, you know, they took other employees home. Some of them ended up staying with my dad, and my dad was able to take them home, or somebody else was able to escort them to where they would be safe other than that building.
So how did you, your father, and your family members, how did they hunker down? Can you tell me a little about that?
So my dad and my mom and I have a four-year-old little sister and my grandma, which we all work together at the steakhouse. When I say it's a family affair, it quite literally is a family affair. They actually got down into our bathtub and were able to put some things over them to protect themselves from any debris or anything like that. But the way that I just keep hearing it being explained is it was just this ungodly sound of just things breaking and things flying and the screeching and the roaring, and then it sounded like a train coming down. And
yeah, well, I mean, and this is a part of the country that is used to storms and tornadoes. So from your family members, this is something they had never heard, never experienced in their lives, yeah?
No. Pictures just don't do any sort of justice to the damage that our town has suffered. I mean, the town is gone. Everything is leveled. You just look around and it honestly looks like a scene out of a war movie.
Wow, and what about your home?
Thankfully, our home is still standing. We do think that we have a gas leak, and, you know, three out of four of our electric company's substations were taken down by the tornado as well. So we're expecting, I mean, several weeks with no electricity, and, I mean, we might have some minor roof damage, but for living less than 5 minutes away from our family business, we were extremely fortunate.
And what about the damage to the restaurants? What happened to them?
The restaurants are completely leveled. The barn got shifted forward, and most of their things from inside actually got blown across the street into the steakhouse. But the steakhouse was a very old building. It was built, years and years and years and years and years ago. So it wasn't really supported by any wood. It was all brick, which is why we knew that it was not safe for anybody to be there during that storm. and the brick just buckled on top of each other, and it fell. It collapsed completely.
So this is a starting over situation for these businesses, yeah?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I feel terrible for these little mom and pop shops who, you know, they've been here for since I've even been alive, and you know, they're tired, and you know, most of them probably won't rebuild, and those ones that do, it's going to be a very long, long road to rebuild.
Will your family rebuild?
We would love to, you know, consider that a possibility, but, you know, it has only been, you know, a couple of days since this happened, so we haven't really had time to assess just what we want to do yet. My heart just hurts for my whole community, because we really are such a family here. When you have a small town like that, everybody knows everybody, everybody checks on everybody, and everybody's hurting.
Sierra Carr, her family lost two restaurants, Carr's Steakhouse and Carr's Barn Barbecue, both in Mayfield, Kentucky, to the storms and tornado this weekend. Sierra, our best to you and your family, and thank you.
Thank you so much.
A big picture look at the tornado's aftermath in Mayfield now with Chris Kenning, who reports for the Louisville Courier-Journal. Chris, would you tell us what is around you now, what you're seeing?
Sure. The Mayfield's downtown has been utterly decimated. The courthouse has been torn apart. Most of the businesses, the fire station, and when you look down through the neighborhoods, you can just see block after block of destruction.
You wrote a pretty harrowing piece over the weekend after you did interviews with people in Mayfield. Could you tell us about some of those you spoke with and what you heard from them?
I spoke with some of the survivors of one of the places where the tornado hit the hardest. It was a candle factory that the night that the tornado hit had about 110 people working inside. And it just tore the place apart, collapsed, I talked to a woman who had been sheltering in a bathroom, and everything just collapsed around her, and was able to finally crawl out with a couple of others, and saw coworkers, you know, perish kind of in front of her eyes. It was really shaken up.
How did she describe what happened when the tornado came through?
You know, she said that they got warning, and they were taken to an area of shelter. And she and a couple other people had said that the sound, the intensity of the sound started increasing. There was a loud boom, and then suddenly the place just started coming apart, and the ceiling and roof fell on top of them. There were heavy barrels of chemicals. There were concrete. There was steel. And she told me that she could hear screams that she just couldn't get out of her head.
So right now, there's the physical work of clearing down trees, also trying to help people who are still unaccounted for. And then there's the problem of restoring cell service. What kind of help is coming to a place like Mayfield that was so hard hit?
A lot of people I spoke with that were just grateful to have survived the tornado, now, a few days later, are starting to see another battle unfolding. Much of the town still lacks water, electricity, gas. The natural gas was turned off because of leaks. And the weather had turned cold, getting very cold at night. Some people are heading to shelters. Some people are heading to motels. Yesterday, the FEMA director was in town promising a flood of new aid, both long-term housing and short-term aid. But for a lot of these families, it's going to be a really tough next few weeks.
Tough to find shelter, tough just to get through, or what?
Yes. We talked to families that are hunkering down in the shells of their homes. One man was running a cord out to his car for power, and they were getting water to bathe with from their water heater. But aid is coming in more and more. There's government agencies. There's a lot of aid groups that are coming in. People are driving in from other states just to help clean up. And so it's a close-knit, small, close-knit town, and people are pulling together.
Just wonder, I don't know if you're from that area, Chris, but what it's like to cover it now.
It's pretty intense. I've covered it several other tornadoes and hurricanes in my days, but when I drove into Mayfield from Louisville, where I live, it just floored me. I mean, the devastation, it really did look like a war zone.
Well, we wish everyone there the best that can be. And thank you very much, Chris Kenning, Louisville Courier-Journal. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Lisa.
Taliban leaders in Afghanistan issued a decree on women's rights this month. The document outlaws child marriage and gives some property rights to widows, but it is silent on women's education and work. In fact, most Afghan women have lost their jobs since the Taliban retook power in August. Our next guest recently wrote an opinion piece. It's called "Afghan Women Deserve a Seat at the Table." Wajma Froga is co-founder of the Women in Peace Studies organization in Afghanistan, and she's a member of the Afghan Women's Network. Wajma, very good to have you.
Thank you so much.
So can I ask you first about life for Afghan women right now under the Taliban? I understand many women are no longer working and many girls are no longer in school. So what options exist right now?
So I work with a group of almost 100 women from all 34 provinces. And after August 15, we started a communication group where we check on everybody on a daily basis, and they are in different parts of the country. So the stories are, of course, heartbreaking. What you hear in the media, that girls are not able to go to school, women are not able to go to work. So all that, public life opportunities have been literally taken away overnight. These women, they were, working in different departments of the government. They were working, in the NGOs, teachers or doctors. So all of them lost their jobs. But more than that, this whole fear, the threats that, these women are facing on a daily basis. For example, this early morning, I got the picture of one of the members who showed a Taliban pickup full of armed men outside her door, and she just took it from her balcony and said, "If you don't hear from me again, goodbye." That is the level of fear that the women and men in the communities are going through, because the Taliban are treating, like in the words of some of these women, is that they are treating us like criminals because they think that we are co-conspirators of the former government. We are the U.S. puppets, and that's why the violence, being beaten on a daily basis if you go out, living there on a daily basis with this fear has really taken a huge toll on everybody, and especially women and children.
Now, you are describing the Taliban appearing to take vengeance on, people they assume are allies of the previous government. Is there a sense that the Taliban are particularly targeting women in these cases?
Yesterday, one of these women were telling us that Taliban commanders go around different homes or the community, or sometimes they come in the mosque. So they tell the mullah in the mosque that you have to make sure that all the men in the community learn how to control the women here, because these are the women who are creating troubles for, the Taliban. They are the ones who are protesting on the streets. Even girls who have been stopped from going to school, they started reading circles, like amazing ways of the way they are kind of coping with the situation. And that's what, the Taliban are afraid of.
Yeah. Well, as you say that, I'm thinking about a line in your opinion piece where you say, "The Taliban must confront the fact that millions of schoolgirls cannot unlearn how to read."
That's so true. What I say, that it's not the communities that need to get used to the Taliban. It's actually the Taliban that need to get used to the communities. For 20 years, we dined in the cafes, we had our gyms, we became ministers, we became ambassadors, we ran governments, we ran organizations for 20 years. So imagine a girl who was 5 years of age in 2001, and now she's 25, right? So that girl has gone to school. That girl has gone to university. She has, a Facebook page, a Twitter page. She has connected through Instagram. So all of what that globalized experience that the millions of young generations have gone through, you cannot take them away. I don't know why the Taliban are not acting smart. I don't know.
Hmm. Well, speaking of the Taliban, I want to ask about your thoughts on this special decree. It is silent on education and employment for women. But I imagine some would argue, listen, this is the start in a positive direction. Your thoughts?
I laughed at it when I saw it because I'm somebody who spent my life working on the laws that protected women in the first place, right? We got the first elimination of violence against women law, the EVAW law in Afghanistan in 2009. I worked on it along with other women from 2004 until 2009. We have female prosecutors for violence against women. We had, you know, a whole structure that they turned a blind eye to and suddenly started that old school kind of decree. And the Taliban leadership has no connection in terms of enforcement. Yes, it might make the international community, the Americans, happy that, yes, the Taliban are very much pro-women. But, you know, for us as Afghans who live under this situation, we literally laugh at it.
Mm. As I hear you say this, it makes me wonder if this is going to bring more clashes. I mean, as you described, there's a whole generation of women who are changed, who are emboldened. At the same time, you have members of the Taliban who may want to go back to 1996.
You know, my question, from the Taliban have been that how many you can kill, how many you can suppress, right? 40 million people live in Afghanistan. How many of them you can continue killing? I see it more than clashes. I see it as a war in the making because the country is a combination of so many different ethnic groups that do not see themselves in the Taliban emirate, like the Shias, Hazaras, the Tajiks, for example. They are not the people that you can continue suppressing somewhere. So, you know, and then the prospect of, you know, foreign fighters. So remember, Afghanistan has been having these huge number of foreign fighters. We have Chinese Uyghurs who are fighting there, you know, in Badakhshan province where we are bordering with China, some 1,000 East Turkestan Islamic movement is present, to French Algerians who have been, you know, fighting in Faria. And we also remember, we have these 300 armed forces from the former government, who are not all of them have left the country. They are hiding in the country. They have somehow access to those ammunitions. So for their own protection, and because the Taliban continue to do revenge killing, so they have to protect themselves. How do you protect yourself? You know, through arming and or, you know, joining an armed group. So the Taliban need to act smartly. We don't want another war on terror. We don't want another 9/11. We don't want, you know, another 20 years of forever war. We want, you know, the Taliban to actually embrace Afghanistan and work towards a better society, because we are not starting from zero. We have built institution for 20 years.
Let me turn and ask you about everyday life now in Afghanistan. The economy, I read, is in shambles. I mean, daily life is so challenging. And you write that women have to play a central role, and one area is delivering aid across the country. Can you explain that?
So we have, you know, so many communities that, one, of course, we have these huge number of war widows, that male aid workers cannot reach them if they do not have female aid workers. Also that for women and children, access to aid becomes very hard. I have reports where aid packages have been sold out. They give it to the man and the family. This man, for example, wants, you know, cash. So what he does is that he doesn't take the food to his wife and seven children. He actually, you know, sells it in the market and uses the cash for his own expenses. And this is something that we are looking in so many communities. That's why we really need, you know, female aid workers to go inside the home, because homes would not open their doors to, just the way we need female vaccinators to do the vaccination, because families would not allow a male vaccinator inside their home. Otherwise, you know, the women and children are the ones who are suffering. And you know what? The worst part that continuously happens is the selling of these children. Like my colleagues were telling me that this week in the market, a father brought two of his girls, 5 and 7 years old, and he said, I'm selling these if anybody wants to buy them. So that is the level of, you know, disparity among, and who is suffering? It's the women and children.
And on this topic of foreign aid, of course, a lot of it is being withheld right now from governments, including the U.S. government, that are imposing financial sanctions on the Taliban. And this must be felt on the inside by the people who are struggling. You criticize the international community also for sending all male delegations to sit across from Taliban leaders to talk about these things. What should the outside world do?
Today's situation is a direct consequence of the U.S. Doha deal and that hasty withdrawal that U.S. did. U.S. left Afghanistan in the middle of the night, you know, the Bagram Air Base, which was the symbol of this 20 years of U.S. presence. But anyways, today, what we want from the international community, particularly the U.S. government, open your embassy in Kabul. You signed a deal with the Taliban. Now come and manage them. If those sanctions, you know, were of worry to you, you wouldn't have signed a deal with them, and your foreign secretary was shaking hands with the Taliban leader in Doha. So you can sign a deal with them, but cannot send food so that women and children don't die. This is hypocrisy. So we very much, you know, want the U.S. government to engage with the Taliban. There is a responsibility that the U.S. has, because what I'm also afraid is that we don't want, after 20 years, then another U.S. war in Afghanistan, right? Remember, the Taliban as a jihadi, as an Islamist group, they have their roots, they have their support from Al-Qaeda, they have support from Hezbollah to Boko Haram to Al-Shabaab in Somalia. So they have their international solidarity. And if this group does not see that they are collapsing, because they cannot even feed their soldiers, they would go to their own jihadi groups. And then, you know, you have Afghanistan as another heaven for terrorism, and then something again happens, and then the U.S. plans to come back. That's restarting the whole thing, and how many lives are being lost.
Wajma Farooq is an activist and co-founder of the Women in Peace Studies organization in Afghanistan, and she's a member of the Afghan Women's Network. Wajma Farooq, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
Millions of Americans will soon have to restart payments on their federal student loans. They got a pass for nearly 2 years because of the pandemic, but the Biden administration says it won't extend the grace period, so it ends in January. Jill Schlesinger is a CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
February 1st is when payments start back up for most federal student loans. How has the deferment during the pandemic affected borrowers? In other words, do we know if they spent or saved the money that would have gone to the government?
I think there are a lot of people who are feeling the pressure of this day coming up. And we know from surveys that there are a lot of the folks who were on the forbearance plan who are really worried about making these payments. But, you know, listen, there was not much to do. If you lost your job, you were just struggling. There are a group of folks who were very lucky, and they were putting aside some of the money they were earning because they kept their jobs. And they actually have a unique opportunity to start shaving years off the life of their loans because of the 0% interest that has been applied, for, as you said, for almost 2 years. And those are the fortunate ones. I think the vast majority are just kind of freaking out and saying, I can't believe this is starting up again.
So what kind of advice do you have for them? Because the deadline is fast approaching when they have to start paying again.
Yeah, first things first. I mean, of course, we're talking about federal student loans. So this is very important. There are a lot of people out there who have private loans, and some of those may be on forbearance. But what I'm about to talk about is the federal loan program. The vast majority of borrowers do owe money to the government. So you need to prepare for repayment by first going to studentaid.gov, which is the main website. And you want to go and look at your profile. You want to update your contact information. You probably have a loan servicer address that you can do that with, but just make sure that that's done. Then there's actually a unique tool that's on the website called a loan simulator, and it's going to help you delineate which repayment plan meets your needs right now. Some people have jobs, they can maybe afford to pay more, some don't. There are also those folks who may want to apply for an income-driven repayment plan. And this sounds really good in the abstract. Hey, I want a lower payment every month based on how much money I earn. But remember, this can add years to a loan. So it may work for this moment, but it really has to be done carefully. So those are the main things that you need to think about to prepare.
So it's interesting. You can actually state what kind of, or review what kind of payment plan you want to have. Is there any way to tell if those who pay student loans who were having difficulty before the pandemic are in any better position or worse position to pay back loans now?
I think the vast majority, and again, I don't know this for this second because we're really not going to know this until we start up again. But according to a lot of the surveys, those people who were struggling before, meaning the people who were late or having problems keeping up, are still struggling. This makes sense if you think about it, because there are people who have been for years struggling to keep up. I think that the more important aspect of this moment in time is a recasting of a student loan possibility for somebody, meaning, as you said, you may want to refinance it in a private setting, which sometimes will give you a cheaper rate, but staying in the federal system is really what's going to keep you with as many options as possible. There also may be some people who have gone into public service who may be able to actually qualify for the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. You should definitely check that out if you're working for a nonprofit.
Thank you. Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. The dawn of biotechnology was the 1970s, and the company Biogen was one of the pioneers. It's based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it's had major successes. Among them, Biogen developed a series of powerful and lucrative medicines that transformed the treatment of multiple sclerosis. But this year, the company had a major fail. It centered around its drug designed to delay the progression of Alzheimer's disease, called Aduhelm. It's the first Alzheimer's treatment in a generation, and Biogen was counting on it to be transformational for those with the disease and revolutionary for the company. The FDA approved the drug this summer, despite lingering questions about how well it works. The approval and the lead-up to it are now the subject of a federal investigation, and Biogen is reeling, reportedly preparing to lay off 1,000 of its 9,000 workers around the globe. Damian Garde covers biotech for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. He co-authored a report about Biogen, saying the tumult there is a cautionary tale of ambition, hubris, and what happens when dysfunction derails best-laid plans. He writes about one person in particular.
A real key figure is a guy named Al Sandrock, who rose to become head of the company's research, development, and medicine operation. So truly, you know, this is a science-based company, and he's the top scientist. So Sandrock is widely considered within Biogen and in the industry as kind of the brains behind the best medicines the company has ever made. And he, in recent years, really devoted himself to developing and winning FDA approval for Aduhelm, which would become the first new treatment for Alzheimer's disease in 20 years, or roughly 20 years.
So he was in every step of the way on the development of this new drug, Aduhelm. And we should say that even though most people won't know the name Al Sandrock, Wall Street pays attention when you have a scientist like that who's a bit of a legend with a company like Biogen.
Absolutely. And that made Biogen kind of an interesting member of the biotech community, that the guy investors wanted to talk to, the guy reporters wanted to talk to, frankly, was not the CEO, but rather it was Al Sandrock, who is kind of this oracle of neuroscience. He's well-spoken, obviously, he has a charm to him, and he became very much like the face of Biogen.
Okay, so getting back to Aduhelm, and we should say once again here, Alzheimer's disease has ruined so many lives and disassembled so many families and caused so much pain that there was so much interest in getting a new drug on the market and really a drug that would be considered a game changer. This is what Al Sandrock had put so much effort into, and obviously those who are working behind the scenes at Biogen as well. Here he is talking in October of 2019 when Biogen announced that it was applying to the FDA for approval of this Alzheimer's drug, Aduhelm.
We believe this is a turning point in the fight against Alzheimer's disease because if approved, this would be the first drug of its kind, a drug that actually slows the clinical decline.
So that's Al Sandrock. Damian, what were the hopes for Aduhelm within Biogen?
Alzheimer's affects, I think, about 6 million people in the United States. You extrapolate that to their family members. It's not an abstract concept to them. And so to feel like you could put your fingerprints on this thing that could really make a difference for these millions of people in the US and eventually in the world, I mean, an incredibly animating thing. We spoke to a lot of former Biogen scientists, and you know, they have diverging opinions, or often quite negative opinions, about how the decisions the company has made. But none of them regret the work they did for this, you know, I mean, they're well compensated, but this almost kind of holy mission to really change the lives of people with, as you mentioned, just a devastating disease.
So what happened at the FDA?
Yeah, things got pretty interesting. So, you know, it's important to note that from that time, October 2019, where Sandrock was speaking, Aduhelm didn't exactly work in the clinical trials that Biogen ran. And the news at that time was that Biogen had taken a harder look at the data and said, we think we see a positive signal where we could make a compelling argument that actually it did work. If you look at it this way, that way, whatever.
This is a really interesting time because at one point it was kind of pulling its bets on Aduhelm. And then suddenly it said, well, wait, when you read the data this way, things look a lot better. And we're now going to go forward and go to the FDA. That raised a lot of hopes.
It did, and it also raised a lot of hackles. You know, I think a lot of people, especially on Wall Street, looked at that and said, are we sure you guys are living in the same reality? The FDA is never going to go for this. There's a tried and true way of deeming whether a clinical trial has succeeded, and yours has almost unequivocally failed. But they would all be proven wrong, because what we didn't know at the time is that Biogen had already been in conversation with the FDA, and the FDA had already said it was amenable to Biogen's read of the data. And basically from summer 2019, for the next roughly 2 years, Biogen and the FDA were in almost constant communication about how to look at these data, what do they really mean? And then in June 2021, I mean, I'm fast forwarding through a lot of interesting stuff, but the world got the, I think, fairly shocking news that in fact the FDA would approve Aduhelm, that the FDA agreed with Biogen's take, which is that while the trials we mentioned did not succeed by the standard definition of success, there was enough of a sign there that convinced the FDA to grant an accelerated approval, which is sort of jargon for an approval in which we're assuming the drug actually works the way it's supposed to, and give Biogen the right to begin selling it and doctors the right to begin prescribing it.
When you say that Biogen was in almost daily conversation with the FDA, this is Al Sandrock in particular who was in conversation with them, the person who supervised the development of this drug. And then once the FDA gave its approval, there was huge fallout. What happened within the FDA and among its advisors and at Biogen?
It became a debacle. I mean, there was just like scientists and people who follow regulatory science who were very upset at the FDA for what they perceived to be an erosion of the standard. The FDA is often considered the gold standard. And this appeared to them like potentially opening the floodgates for treatments that may not work at all and will undoubtedly be expensive to be available to patients. And there can be great consequences to that. Then you have Biogen's decision to set a price for the drug that they say would average out to about $56,000 a year per patient. This was, you can imagine, enraging to people who are already sensitive about drug prices. But likewise, investors on Wall Street were expecting Biogen to charge somewhere around $10,000 to $15,000 for the drug.
And also, we should say insurance companies, many of them declined to reimburse for it, and a lot of doctors are refusing to prescribe it. There's one other person that I want you to bring in here, and we're skipping over a lot of the story. We will post it, though. But this is the CEO, Michelle Vounatsos, who was very much an admirer and supporter of Al Sandrock, the scientist who we're talking about here. What was going on, very briefly, behind the scenes between the two of them once the FDA approved, very controversially, this new Alzheimer's treatment?
So just as Aduhelm proved to be a breaking point of public perception of Biogen, likewise, it ended up straining relationships inside the company. So as all of that negative press was heaped on them, all of the criticism over the price, and then maybe most importantly, the really, really disappointing financial returns of the company, there began to be sort of a game of musical chairs as to who was going to take the blame for this. What our reporting has led us to understanding. And so cut to November, there is the shocking announcement that Al Sandrock will be retiring effective the end of this year. What we learned is that he was pushed out, that he was kind of made to bear the brunt of this because the reaction was so polarizing that there was a perception that someone needed to be the face of what is a PR failure on this company's behalf. And so the way people characterized it to us was, it was going to be Vounatsos or Sandrock, and Sandrock was on the losing end.
And at the same time, though, Biogen is also working on another potential Alzheimer's treatment that's in late-stage development. There's a lot riding on that one. How has Biogen's ignominious experience affected other biotechs working on Alzheimer's drugs? Has it had a chilling effect? Has it made them more ambitious or less?
It's interesting because, you know, Eli Lilly, the massive pharmaceutical company, has a treatment that works somewhat similarly to Aduhelm. It's a different drug in late stage development. And their stock price has actually gone up much, much more than Biogen's has in light of the approval of Aduhelm, because there's a perception among some people that they might be able to step in. You know, Aduhelm did the blocking and tackling. Now the FDA has agreed to approve these kinds of medicines. And Eli Lilly might step in with a conceivably better, but at least a drug with less baggage than this one. And so the industry might march on and make a great deal of money based in large part on Biogen's pioneering research and Biogen's efforts to win over hearts and minds at the FDA. And so the legacy of Aduhelm may be that it did indeed open a floodgates, but that Biogen itself didn't manage to actually profit from it. And, you know, based on what we've seen so far and will likely see in the coming months, will actually kind of be punished for this work that they've done.
Damien Garday is a biotech reporter for Stat. Thanks, Damien.
Thanks for having me.
Fingers crossed for clear skies tonight, wherever you are. One of the most reliable meteor showers, the Geminids, will peak in the wee hours tonight and into tomorrow morning. Oh, and there is also a once-in-a-lifetime comet buzzing close to Earth that makes two heavenly reasons to connect with Kelly Beatty. He's senior editor of Sky and Telescope. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, hello, Scott.
Now, I understand these Geminids are kind of the old faithful of meteor showers. Why is this such a reliable show?
Most people know about the Perseid meteors in August, but honestly, the Geminids are the best show of the year. They are reliable because the source of these meteors is a tiny asteroid, almost a rock comet, if you will, called Phaethon, that comes very close to the sun. It has a short orbit, and that sunlight beating down on it at more than 1,000 degrees causes little bits of the object to spall off, spread around its orbit, and this time every year we plow through those. They hit our atmosphere at about 20 miles a second and create this really dependable display of shooting stars or meteors in the sky.
And I understand peak viewing is tonight. Where and when should we go out and look?
Yes, we're lucky and unlucky. Lucky in the sense that the peak of the shower occurs overnight for us here in North America. Perfect timing. Unlucky in the sense that there's a fat moon in the sky. Now, ordinarily, under perfectly dark skies, you could expect to see at least one meteor per minute from a dark location. The moon is going to spoil that a little bit. I think if you go out as early as 9 o'clock at night, you'll start to see a few meteors. This shower is famous for lots of bright ones, fireballs, we call them. And if you are dedicated, then I encourage you to stay up very late tonight or get up early tomorrow morning after the moon has set. There's about a two-hour window when the moon will be gone from the sky, and that's when the meteors will be at their best.
And so that is, what, something like 2 to 4 in the morning? What's that window?
That would be fine. 3 to 5 maybe is a little better. And, you know, you'll see meteors all night long, but the strongest pulse of them will be in those hours before dawn tomorrow morning.
And if it's a cloudy evening, is tonight the only shot we get?
It is not, actually. You can, you know, there'll be fewer of them tomorrow night and the night thereafter. This is a shower with a fairly sharp peak. So please do get outside if it's clear where you are.
Okay. Celestial sighting number 2, a comet named Leonard, which I understand is named after the scientist who discovered it. This is a once in an 80,000-year opportunity. What's it look like?
So right now it is moving between us and the sun, and it's emerging into the evening sky just after sunset. Because it's between us and the sun, there is some chance that the dust particles in its tail will kind of light up. You might need a pair of binoculars to see this comet. It is not nearly as bright or as obvious as Comet Neowise was last year. But it is there, and it's waiting for us here in the Northern Hemisphere. Figure out what time sunset is for you. Wait 30 to 45 minutes when the twilight is just starting to deepen, and look in the west and southwest for the comet. Low to the horizon, not very far above the horizon. It'll look like a small, fuzzy ball, maybe with a short tail sticking upright. And that's telling you that you're looking at a comet and not just a star.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, finally, you recently returned from Antarctica, where there was a total solar eclipse on December 4th. What'd you see, and what made that eclipse unique?
Well, what makes it unique is that it's so far south, it literally was seen over Antarctica and these tiny islands called the South Orkneys, and that was the only land. I was on one of about 15 ships in the Southern Ocean, as it's now called, in the path of the moon's shadow. The eclipse happened for us at 4 in the morning because it's daylight pretty much all the time down there. Unfortunately for us, it was cloudy. And so we did experience the eclipse because the shadow still passed over us. And even though it was cloudy, it got seriously dark very abruptly, very dark for being in the middle of the morning. So that was a thrill for everyone on board. Of all those ships, only one ship actually got to see totality, got to see the moon completely cover the sun. Everyone who was viewing from Antarctica, and there were quite a few people who flew down there for this, got to see a brilliant solar eclipse near the horizon in the middle of the midnight sun.
Kelly Beattie is senior editor at Sky and Telescope. Kelly, always great to have you. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, Scott. Clear skies to all.
Clear skies to you. And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. It's Here and Now.